You're listening to When the Night Comes, a collection of sounds and stories from unsigned Birmingham bands between 1985 and 2005. Musicians go back in time, dusting off old demo tapes and sharing some of the tracks they wrote in bedrooms, garages and studios across the city. My name is Dean Vernals. Series 1, Episode 4 of this podcast covers the work of Gum, and I'll be in conversation with guitarist and singer Bob Buxton. We'll also reflect on some of the other projects he's been involved in over the years. Formed in 1996, Gum were a three-piece, and as well as Bob featured Ash Orton on bass and Nick Eustace on drums. They played a number of gigs on the Birmingham music scene in their short time together, as well as recording a four-track demo. So, let's hear their story. Bob, great to have you on episode 4 of the podcast. This is the first one where I've not been in the same room as the guests due to social distancing.
You wouldn't want to be in the same room as me at the moment, Dean, because I'm here in my underpants.
Oh, dear. Now, technically, this is unsigned Birmingham bands, but two-thirds of the lineup were from Bromsgrove.
That's right, yeah. Myself and Nick were from Bromsgrove. But Ash, obviously, was a sort of a Selly stroke Cotteridge type boy, and really our operation sort of centered out of his bedroom, so I think we can probably just sneak under the radar as a Birmingham band.
Now, I first met you back in 1994 when you turned up to audition for a band I was putting together with Ash Orton, who you just mentioned. The previous band we were in, The Shore, had broken up a few months before. We were just looking to do something new. I remember you came along with a few introspective acoustic numbers to play us, very different in style to Gum. What do you remember about your early experiences of writing songs?
Probably I have to go right back to childhood. I think there was basically a switch in my head that would never turn off, and there was always melodies flying around. It's all just always sort of been there, really. And quite funny, really, in school, I'd get told off from the teacher for humming a tune. I wouldn't even realise I was doing it. I remember there was this old acoustic guitar hidden away in the back of the garage that had about three strings on it. I remember sort of, oh, you know, that's a bit of fun. And then my next memory really was seeing this film, Cat Ballou, and seeing the geezer, he was playing a banjo. I was like, I've got to try me that. So I was like badgering my parents, and eventually they relented and got me one. And then finally, when I was 14, I badgered them into getting me an electric guitar. That really made sense to me then. And I started sort of copying riffs from music that I liked, learning how to string chords together, really just figuring out how the guitar worked and, you know, the relationship between the strings, how to shape my fingers and that sort of stuff. And then around that time, I started writing lyrics as well. I was listening to a lot of metal around then, and I seem to recall there was some pretty dodgy stuff, you know, on Dungeons and Dragons and whatnot. But it was all learning, I think, and as I gained experience, I was getting the idea, you know, that when the time came, I'd be ready to join or form a band. You know, that was sort of a role I was envisioning for myself, and I felt like I was getting a style. I mean, the main thing I took from it and still do, it was a powerful sense of satisfaction and enjoyment from making music. I mean, it can be frustrating when you have an idea and maybe it doesn't come out like you can hear it in your head. But, you know, when you get a good lyric and a good melody and some harmonies in the music, that's just one of the best things in life for me. And it really still is, you know, that's why I'm still involved in music today.
Yeah. I mean, songwriting is quite a personal thing, isn't it? What comes first, the words or the music for you?
I don't think there's ever really a single route to achieving a complete song. I mean, I can be tooling around on the guitar, you know, just absentmindedly playing while I'm watching the telly or something, and maybe a riff will come out or I'll get an idea, but it won't necessarily translate into a song right away. And likewise with words, I might come up with a line or two or get an idea, and it's just a matter of jotting them down, and maybe sometimes things will just sort of just stay in my head for a bit. And there are times when I can sit down and everything comes out all at once, and that can be pretty freaky because it's like the lightning strike moment, and like, you know, 10 minutes later, there was something there that didn't exist before. And it can just sort of feel so easy and effortless. And you really spend time wondering where it comes from. Yeah. I just love those moments, the lightning strike moments. But equally, you can have something that's strong. It just doesn't come out right. You know, you're trying to maybe force it to finish it, and then it just doesn't come out right. So you kind of have to learn to walk away from those moments.
I mean, I've heard a lot of your songs over the years. Actually, it's quite a diverse mix of stuff.
I guess that comes from your influences in a way, but yeah, you seem to write in lots of different styles.
Yeah, but I think, like you say, it would reflect in my taste in music, because I've never understood the tribalism. I think certainly going back to like the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of tribalism. You know, you were Britpop or you were a rocker or, you know, all those sorts of things. I listen to everything. So I think that probably comes out in the stuff that I write.
I mentioned a few minutes ago when you came along to play those acoustic numbers, I actually came across a dusty old tape of those recently and digitised it. But what do you remember about writing those tunes, Love is Misery, Solitaire?
The old acoustic tunes, I remember it wasn't actually an acoustic. It was more of an electric guitar, a big hollow-bodied thing.
Oh, yeah.
This big black one. I think Ash nicknamed it the Coffin.
Okay.
I think that's more to do with this, because it was, you know, big and black rather than, because, well, it might have been to do with the dirgy songs that I was bringing along to the rehearsals at the time. I don't know. But it just, I suppose, those songs that I wrote back then just sort of reflected where I was. It was just basically, it's me in a bedroom, maybe not playing in a band at that time. More experimenting with that sort of acoustic style.
That was a little extract from Love is Misery, one of the tracks you were discussing a few moments ago. Now, a lot of writers tap into the idea of music, songs, having a social relevance and capturing the lives of people. Is that an approach you've ever taken?
I think I've written a couple of things that were vaguely political or social. Mm-hmm. But by and large, I think I'm driven more by observation. Interpersonal politics, really, maybe, than sort of the electioneering and that sort of thing, and maybe sort of assessing and criticizing my own feelings and reactions to life. I mean, there's been some confessional stuff and some sort of story driven metaphor type stuff. I think probably this is going to sound terribly pretentious, but I probably use like Bowie's cut up technique.
Oh, yeah.
And maybe I've done that once or twice as well, just in terms of lyrics. But really with lyrics, you know, everyone's going to interpret them differently, aren't they? It's very individual to the listener.
And,
you know, and there isn't a rule that says this has to make sense to everyone, or indeed it doesn't have to make sense to anyone. But songs, you know, they're generally an attempt for me to try and make sense of a world that continues to confuse me. Well into my 40s now.
Now, that little project didn't really go anywhere, unfortunately, did it? And around 1996, Gum were formed. And you're the first three-piece to appear on the podcast, actually. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about how the band got together?
So I kind of met the Shore guys, as you said, in about 94. And I seem to recall we jammed at Rabana's. And we were trying to get an original four-piece going. Me and Ash got on great outside of the jam sessions and formed a pretty strong friendship. So I would pop over to his quite regularly. We'd be talking music a lot and using his four track. He had this quite a large thing. It was a Tascam. Which to me, I mean, that was just a wonderful machine. Up until this point, I'd only had my parents' kitchen sort of mini boombox thing like you probably get from Argos, which just had this little you know, sort of like an external mic on it. So you just pop a cassette in and just press record, and you know, so you're starting to work on with a Tascam. It was really a step up just in terms of experimenting with songs, being able to put layers on and exploring writing and ideas that I would not have thought possible before. I mean, and Ash was really supportive and would keep encouraging me.
Yeah.
It was great getting immediate feedback like that. And again, like you're experimenting and you've got that second pair of ears there going, yeah, go on, keep going. That sounds great. You know,
yeah.
So you find out what works and what doesn't.
Yeah.
Now, as you mentioned, the band didn't really take off in any way. And in 1995, I got asked by an old school friend to join a rock four-piece back in Bromsgrove at Harry's Game. Their bass player was going to university. And I'd never owned a bass up until that point, but Ash had shown me some stuff and he'd let me have a go on his bass. So I felt like it was something I could do. And seem to recall, I managed to pick up it. It was a Sun Mustang bass. I can't remember the price, but it was a good price. It's Pandora's Box.
Down in Sturchley.
Brilliant. I think it's still there, isn't it?
I think it's closed down now. The sign's there, but the shop's still, you know, above the shop, but it doesn't trade anymore.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, that was a right little treasure trove anyway. But anyway, so I got my bass and then I was able to join up with Harry's Game. And that's where I met Nick because he was drumming for that band. And we had quite the adventure for a short time, a lot of gigs, including we played down in London at the Astoria 2. And we all put a lot of effort. You know, and you're really trying to make it, we're going to make it. But that was quite short lived. I didn't really get on too great with the singer at times. So I ended up leaving, but I stayed on good terms with Nick. And, so really I kind of had Ash supporting me on the one side and he was playing bass and he was hearing my songs and he was thinking, yeah, I kind of, you know, I like what's coming. And obviously Nick was there and all of a sudden the band was in a bit of a disarray. So I sort of chose my moment to pounce and sort of played him a couple of the songs and then, managed to sort of convince him it would be a good idea to be in a three-piece.
Was it always the intention to be a three-piece?
Yeah, in my mind, definitely. I mean, back in college, way, way younger, there had been a couple of three-piece bands, and I really liked the dynamic. I must admit, I still do. I've probably done more three-pieces than anything over the years.
Okay.
I kind of like it in a way. People have to step up to sort of make up for that fourth member not being there. There's nowhere to hide, musically speaking. So I think it sort of pushes. I don't know, there's more space. And there's more freedom for the players in the band to sort of, you know, push on and achieve something they wouldn't do if there was that fourth person there making X amount of noise. You know, you kind of got to make up for that person.
Yeah. Interesting thoughts. Now, singer-songwriter Jay Watson from the psychedelic rock bands Tame Impala and Pond now records solo material under the name Gum. But what do you remember about how you settled on the name?
Well, firstly, Jay Watson's going to be hearing from my solicitor. No, joking. I love Tame Impala. There were a couple of things at play at the time, and I'm sure this was something that you touched on with the Palantine's episode.
Oh yes, yeah.
Back in '96, there were a lot of indie-ish band names, with single syllable names. So you had like Blur, Lush, Pulp, Suede. Yeah. A lesser known Cud.
A lot
of U's going on. So Gum fit in with that. But conversely, so I like what the chap from the Palantine said, but they were looking to stand out from all the other names. And it's interesting, a different approach. The second thing was there was actually a song called Gum, which made mention of Australia in the lyrics. And Nick loved it because he'd done some travelling down in Oz and really enjoyed the reference and the song. So there, it was pretty easy to say, well, that could be a band name. I later developed a story that we would call the first album E. Not because we were into drugs or anything, because we weren't into anything stronger than, you know, a lager or maybe a bourbon or something. But when the time came and Ace Radio 1 DJ Mark Goodyear announced our debut album, coming in at number one, he would have to say E by Gum, which my Yorkshire granddad would have smiled about. Probably no one else. It's probably the worst joke in the history.
I was actually expecting you to do it in a Yorkshire accent there.
E by Gum, you know, something like that.
That's more like it. More like it. How did you arrive at this particular soundscape?
I think really the soundscape is probably driven by the gear I could afford at the time. So at the time, the soundscape would sound pretty cheap. So I had this cheap, jangly sort of, I don't know if it was like some sort of Jaguar-shaped guitar, some sort of copy, and this really, probably a really bad and cheap distortion pedal. That was as much as I could afford at the time. And that was more or less it, because I couldn't really afford any other sort of effects pedals or anything. So I don't really think it's a surprise that we ended up doing sort of like the quiet, loud, dynamic. I mean, we were all listening to like Pixies and Nirvana at the time a lot. So it's really, it's out of necessity. That's kind of how we sound, how we did. There were certain things probably we were homing in on. You may or may not pick up, or the audience may or may not pick up when you hear the tracks. Ash was, he was throwing in a lot of sort of Motown style bass, which was probably a bit unusual for, you know, an indie band. And Nick had a really distinctive, and he still does, he has a very distinctive playing style. Kind of very jittery and skittery. That's very much, you know, I've never played with another drummer who plays like Nick does. And I think that really helped us in terms of creating a musical identity for the band. And that was something we were conscious of, trying to develop an identity, a thread between the songs, you know.
Okay, I think it's time to hear the first track you've chosen to play, which is Loopy. What do you remember about writing that?
A bunch of us went down to the Riviera and...
The English Riviera?
The English Riviera, indeed. Okay. Not to be confused with the French Riviera. There's some distance of the distance. I think it was either Torquay or Paignton. And we'd gone for the weekend. And this was back when, I mean, I'm probably showing my age now, but this was back when a posh B&B was probably about £12 a night.
Yeah.
You know, so a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
It was, in fact, the very weekend I talked Nick into joining the band.
Yeah, yeah.
Having softened him up with a few beers on the beachfront on a Saturday afternoon. How could he say no?
Indeed.
So there I was, giddy with excitement, spending the rest of the day celebrating, getting frightfully drunk.
Yeah.
And waking up, quite frankly, with the worst hangover of my life, before or since. We'd arranged to go to Clovelly, which is this, for those that don't know, is this historic Victorian fishing village, and it's very much been left, you know, as it was. And it has to be maintained that way. And we were going there the next morning, and I was in no fit state. So I would just literally lay down in the back of Nick's work van, because that's all I was capable of doing. But of course, he's bombing around the country lanes. I'm getting thrown around the back and just feeling terrible. And I remember quite clearly David Bowie's The Laughing Gnome was playing on the radio.
Okay.
And I thought the gnome was going to kill me. And we got to the village, and it's all these old cobbles and this steep incline down to the harbour. And I'm wearing these really crap trainers, and I can hardly stand up. Not due to the hangover and the steepness of the hill, and, you know, really holding my head, you know, and utterly pathetic. And, you know, perversely, thank heavens that there's a pub at the bottom of the hill. So it was a case of, you know, the hair of the dog. Yeah, so it was no great leap to see where the wobbles and cobbles line came from.
Okay, I think we should hear it, actually.
Okay.
Thank you.
That was Loopy by Gum. Was that typical of how you wrote songs at the time, Bob?
Yeah, I'd say so. I think, really, a quirky lyric, quite opaque if you don't know the backstory. It's a bit of an indie jangle that beefs up in the chorus. Probably I didn't attempt too many solos, so that was, you know, that probably that's a rarity for that particular song that it actually has a solo.
And did you have your own rehearsal space to develop and grow the material?
No. Most of the time we used Apex Studios over in Hales Owen, and the old boy there, bless him, St. Alan of Apex, as we called him, with his Buddy Holly glasses. He was so great. I mean, he was such a lovely guy who got a kick from helping the younger bands come through. Poor old St. Alan passed away a few years back. He's now run by another Alan, funnily enough, whether it's something in the water over there. and it's now called Stage Studios. It's still a great place to go, you know.
And that was sort of like a once a week, twice a week sort of thing, was it?
Yeah, but we used to do some marathon sessions. It'd probably be like 4 hours on a Sunday.
And how important was sort of image to a band like Gum? I mean, lots of bands who influenced your sound had a kind of anti-image almost, didn't they?
Yeah, true. I mean, we didn't really spend a lot of time or thought on the image. It was usually sort of jeans, T-shirt and trainers mostly. We weren't dressing up at all. It was just a case of trying to look like we hung out together, really, rather than something more regimented, like, you know, the Ramones or something.
I mean, I guess eventually you would have been ready to gig. I mean, what do you remember about the first one?
That would have been the Hare and Hounds,
right,
in Kings Heath, which
often
gets a shout on this podcast,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, it does indeed.
I seem to recall Ash either knew their booker or made an approach. I think by that time we did a little recording at the Brown Room at Rich Bitch Studios.
Oh, yeah.
Just like some four songs played live onto a tape. So that might have helped as well in terms of us getting a slot. As for the gig itself, it's lost in the mist of times, I think. I think we played okay, without making too many mistakes. Obviously, I think at that time we were all a bit nervous, you know. Gigs, at least, you know, the good ones, they always seem to go really fast, don't they? The good gigs.
Indeed, yeah. Indeed.
There were some people there. I don't know what they were doing there, but there were some people there watching. They were quite generous with their applause.
Were you supporting someone on that gig?
You know, I can't even... I guess so.
There was no way
we would have been headlining. It was probably like a three-band bill or something.
Now, you weren't really a band that played extensively live, but I remember seeing you at the legendary Jug of Ale, your second ever gig, in fact. I reviewed it for Siren Fanzine back in 1997 and dug out the article recently. And it seems I was quite impressed with a number of things. But what do you remember about the gig?
Well, I made the mistake of really building that gig up in my mind. It was just this massive, mind-blowing thing, you know, like a real bucket list moment. Because I was thinking just too much about all the bands that played there before. I mean, it was stupid, I think, to the point I was so nervous that I didn't enjoy the gig. Actually, I didn't actually enjoy playing that one.
Right.
I mean, I didn't break any strings, but I'm pretty sure the guitar strap came off at one point.
I don't remember that bit. I'm sure I would put it in the review.
Yeah. And another lesson learned, invest in strap locks.
Okay, I think it's time to hear the second track. This is called Supervillain.
Oh,
Okay, that was Supervillain by Gum. How did that one come about, Bob?
Well, I'm pretty sure this was the main one that sold the band idea to the other guys.
Right.
It'd kind of be, oh, look, here's Bob with his little song ideas. And then all of a sudden it was, boom, what's this? You know, this one's got a proper chorus and everything. We could do something with this. So I think that got them excited. I just really remember coming up with the intro riff. The first line of the lyric, and it's one of those songs that kind of wrote itself in 10 minutes, you know.
Okay.
I mean, apart from the middle eight, it's very simple chords, jamming it with the guys. We probably spent a while arranging it, you know, we at the rehearsal room, just trying to put an arrangement on it, making sure it had like a beginning, a middle, and an end. I mean, I look back on that song now, it's, for a pop song, it's probably about a minute too long. So there's things I do now. I keep all the ideas in the song, but just try and trim it down a little bit, trim the fat off, you know.
Yeah, hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I often look back on the bands I've been involved with, really, and think, why didn't we record that track instead of this one? Or I guess that's something a producer may have sort of advised on, really. But, I mean, did you sort of feel you recorded the best material you had at the time?
Well, I think me being me, I'd wanted to record them all, you know. It's like you're like being asked to pick between your children, you know. Probably the ones we recorded were probably the best reflection of where we were at the time.
Let me ask you about how you promoted the band. Did you have a grand plan to conquer the music world?
Probably delusions of grandeur rather than a grand plan. There was very little in the way of promotion. I think we felt like we needed a good quality demo. To have something to give to people who are interested or to drum up interest for gigs.
Was it made with the possibility of attracting record company interest or just to obtain gigs sort of solely?
Yeah, I think kind of we wanted to achieve both. You know, we wanted more gigs, but there was definitely talk about what could happen or what might happen if we got a bit of, you know, record company interest. I mean, Ash had the experience of getting London gigs. And if I remember rightly, the show had some A&R interest, which obviously for any band, that's usually a big stepping stone, isn't it? Yeah. Harry's Game had an experience too, getting involved with some promotion development company. And that's kind of how we ended up getting the gig down at the Astoria too. I mean, really, at the time, it was inconceivable that we would get signed in Birmingham. We had to get the interest in London, but before we could do that, the plan was, you know, build up a following in Birmingham and maybe get some people that would be crazy enough to follow us down there. But obviously, we never got to that part of the plan.
Our final Gum song today is Balance. It's a song I've always really liked. Not that I didn't like any of the others. Was it a particular favourite of yours?
I'd say, again, it's a bit like picking between the kids, isn't it? But I think with Balance, it felt like we were sort of hitting our stride, getting a bit more expansive with how we presented the music. The sound was sounding a bit more confident in itself. I mean, hey, it's a 6-4 song, you know.
And what's behind the lyrics? It sounds quite a personal number.
It's snapshots of childhood. Is sort of the verse lyrics, and then it's describing all the great firsts in life, which is, you know, walking, talking, falling over drunk.
I mean, how did it come about, actually? Was it from a jam, or was it something, or part of a jam, or was it something that you wrote solely yourself?
Generally, what would happen is I would write the songs, I would play them to the guys in the room, and then it would be thumbs up, thumbs down. And if it was a thumbs up, then we'd go in there and sort of bash it around.
Yeah.
I mean, with this particular one, that's definitely me, certainly on the intro. I'm doing My Bloody Valentine on a budget, really giving that tremolo arm some full-on welly.
Yes.
You know, but then also you kind of got the classic Gum thing going on, which is like a jangly verse, and then beefing up to a chorus, which people hopefully thought would be, you know, catchy.
Reminiscent of something Feeder used to do as well on some of their songs, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I think really just the real shame with it was, I think around about that time, Nick sort of left, having got exasperated with how slowly the band was progressing. I think he ended up going back to Harry's, and they got something up and running. I'm a bit hazy again with the passing of time, but I think by the time he might have already gone by the time we recorded this one.
Yeah.
I'm kind of thinking that the producer's brother Mark played drums on this one.
Yeah, Mark Conlon, he's been in quite a few Birmingham bands over the years, and he's helped me on a number of musical projects. Yeah, great drummer.
Mm, yeah, very good.
So I think we should hear Balance.
Let's go for it.
So that was Balance by Gum, and like the other two tracks, it was produced by Steve Conlon. Steve was the singer-guitarist from the band Livewire, who we mentioned in podcast number one. He was also in other Brum bands, Guru Meditation and Fisticuffs, wasn't he?
Yeah, absolute legend, Steve Conlon.
And what do you remember about that experience, recording with him?
Oh, I mean, again, you know, really, really cool experience. Like a lot of the stuff that happened with the band, it was really the connection through Ash. Yeah. Steve lived down the road from Ash's place, and he had what I can only describe as a magic shed at the bottom of his garden. All it was missing was a toilet and room service. You know, it just had everything that a band could want. A band could play in there and the neighbours would be none the wiser. It had a recording desk, the like of which I'd never seen up until that point. You had the vocal booth in between the heavy doors. The door that led in, and then obviously the second door. I mean, a real Aladdin's cave. I mean, his brother did an excellent job on Balance, and there was another track we did as well. But I think at that point, like as opposed to like the first two tracks you played on the podcast, we'd built up a better understanding with Steve, and he really beefed up the production and the sounds. And listening back, I think really you can already hear there's like an evolution of the sound going on. Balance, I guess, was sort of the closest I got to how I wanted the band to sound, like the sound I had in my head, which I suppose was a good a place as any really for the band to finish, you know, finish on a high. I think if we'd have convinced Mark to join the band full time, we probably would have continued, but it just wasn't for him. So, you know, no bads. That was just he didn't want to do it. So I think at that point we were sort of kicking around some other ideas, but that was pretty much the end of Gum.
So we've heard all three tracks now. Are they as good as you remember?
Now, Dean, that's a really loaded question. for me, they've retained their charm, such as it was. I mean, they definitely make me think back to the person I was at that time. I mean, in some ways I've changed a lot, and in other ways I just haven't changed at all.
I mean, if you were forming in 2020, I mean, to be honest, not the best year to be forming a band. Would you think you've been more successful?
I think really, you know, since then you've got all the new technology, you've got social media. The landscape is so different now. Yes, to what it was in terms of promotion. I mean, you used to do fly posting and now you do Facebook posting. You can get a lot of likes on social media, but that doesn't mean people actually like you.
Yeah, of course.
And really, the whole music industry has changed beyond recognition, how music is consumed, you know, people like digital streaming. So in truth, what I have to say is if we'd formed in 2020, the odds of being successful probably would have been about the same, slim to none.
Were there any missing ingredients, do you think? Would you have benefited, say, from having a manager?
You know, that's tricky to know if we'd have benefited or not. I mean, would a manager have said, you know, don't play supervillain, you need to do a Bee Gees cover or whatever? I'm not sure we'd have gone with ideas like that because I suppose we could all be quite stubborn in our own ways. Who knows what might have happened if we'd have had someone who was properly supportive and connected. It's just one of those hypotheticals, isn't it? You, there's no way to know.
Yeah, I was just thinking there about doing a Bee Gees cover and, you know, trying to make the band to sort of stay alive. I'll get my coat.
Now, after Gum, you played in a few other bands, didn't you? And I guess I should know. I was in a couple of them with you, Autopilot, Gravity.
Yeah.
And the songs you were writing around that time had a completely different feel to them compared to, say, the early acoustic stuff and Gum, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, they probably reflect growth as a person, as a musician, you know, a different perspective, opening up to new ideas, experiments, having better gear, you know, different pedals, effect pedals. Obviously, you're always learning from your previous mistakes, or you learn from previous songs what works, what doesn't work. You use that experience going forward. I mean, Autopilot and Gravity, they were about 5 years after Gum.
We're talking about 2000, 2001, really. Now, the two projects didn't really result in any gigs as such. It was always difficult to find a drummer, wasn't it?
Mm.
But we actually recorded a demo whilst in Autopilot over at Barney's studio with Ray Evans, which was part of the old McNabb's Ice Cream Factory over in Garrett's Green. And one track on the CD we put together was one of your songs called The Institute. What do you remember about writing that track?
I think I'd written that song a few years earlier, and it was called sort of, I think it was just, we brought it back into the room, didn't we, and said, look, we'll reshape it when we were at Barney's place. In terms of the song, I think I was thinking back to that time in the mid-90s, and as I recall, the country was in a pretty grim state. All my friends were sort of fed up with what seemed like endless Tory government. I think they were midway through their third term there, John Major and all that sort of stuff. I wasn't really into politics like they were. Like, obviously, some of the students, they were very politically aware. But it seemed like one by one they were drifting away, growing up, going to university, getting a job further away, or just like falling out and finding new friend groups. I know, very human stuff. So the song was like a reflection of that, you know, accepting there's a bit of melancholy that goes with it. You know, I think it's called Growing Older or something like that.
Let's hear it, actually.
this wouldn't matter, 'cause we'd all know I was.
So that was the Institute, and you played lead guitar on that one, didn't you? And left the vocals to me.
Mm.
And Ash Orton also played on that one, as well as Gary Parsons on keyboards.
Yeah, by this time, Nick had moved away from Bromsgrove. He was in a house share over in Worcester, and he was sharing with a couple of geezers, one of whom was Gary.
Yeah.
And Gary was really into his keyboards, and he had this thing with an arpeggiator on it. It was absolutely fantastic. He was coming up with all this sort of trancey sort of Tangerine Dream doing that. And obviously that just really blew me away. We got on, and he was happy to help further the sounds on the songs and the demos I was coming up with. And I think rather than a drum machine, we were using a computer program called Cakewalk to create the drum tracks. Then we could put that onto the Tascam, onto the four track, and then we could do all the other stuff from there.
I mean, and since then you've been involved in other things as well, haven't you?
It probably makes quite a list. All the things I've done over the years. I mean, there have been a number of cover bands, like rock bands, Britpop, acoustic, tributes. And then there have also been some other original acts. I mean, there was a Gum 2 at one point with Gary involved. But again, it was just something that didn't get out of the rehearsal room. But, you know, there were some great songs there. I've always had got something going on, really, just because music is just what I like to do. You know, there's always a pull there that's just never left me. It's not like, oh, I'll do it for a bit and then get fed up and go away. It's always there. There's always some projects going on.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, finally, if you sort of had a message now that you could give to the young Bob Buxton about being a successful musician, what would it be?
That's a good question, you know, because it's interesting to me because my daughter plays guitar now, and she's singing and playing and writing her own songs.
Oh, good.
Kind of very much like I was at her age.
So
I help her record them, and or try and help or advise about aspects of writing or performance. It's really, her lead playing reminds me so much of Kristin Hirsch. From the Throne Muses, which is crazy because that takes me back to when I was my daughter's age. But about being a successful musician, that's tricky because you've kind of got to define what success is.
Yes.
You know, I mean, certainly for me, being satisfied with a new creation is its own success to me.
That's a lovely thought, that, yeah.
Yeah. But also, you know, sometimes you're playing a band and you're just seeing a crowd of people really digging what you're doing. You know, that is a high for sure. Yeah. But best advice to the young Bob Buxton, get the ear protection in early, because I've got this permanent going on in the background and there's nothing I can do about it. And to be honest, I've probably got to blame Metallica for that back in 89, seeing them at the NEC. I don't think my hearing ever got over it. I think other things would be, if you're singing, get vocal lessons, not to be a better singer, just to learn how to look after your voice.
Yes.
Again, what I'm finding with the passage of time, the voice can't do what it did back then, and I find that incredibly frustrating.
Right. Yeah.
And lastly, really, to the young one, you know, when you're in a crowd or like a band situation, at best always to be kind, but, you know, sometimes you've got to stand up to be heard. You know, you've got to stand up to get your ideas heard. Sometimes, you know, sometimes you've got to push a bit, sometimes you've got to pull a bit. You know, if you're going to be in a band, you've got to learn to be a team player.
Some good advice there. Certainly, I wish I considered ear protection back in the day. Sadly, though, that's all we've got time for. You've been a great guest. Thanks for sharing your stories, allowing the tracks to be heard again.
You're welcome.
So, long live the music of Gum and Bob Buxton.
And long live the podcasts of Dean Vernals. Thank you.
When the Night Comes was written and produced by me, Dean Vernals. If you've enjoyed the music in this episode, or were in a Birmingham band and would like to share your story, then get in touch at wtncpodcast@mail.com. That's wtncpodcast@mail.com. Thanks for listening.